Tests, April 1903 to February 1904. During the next year, I learned that the company was more than a group of men wanting money. We were brothers, strangers in a strange land who had banded together for mutual help and protection. There were arguments, of course, but they were always worked out. As for myself, I was treated as a man and not a boy, and the long hours I worked were really no worse than the hours I had worked on our farm. In the mornings, I was the first to get up and make the fire and brew the tea for the others. And through the day, there would be various things I would have to do. I did not go to school during the daytime like demon children, because the demons would not allow me to go to any of their schools just a few blocks away. I could only go to a special school the demons had set up in the Tong people's town, which was so poorly equipped and so poorly staffed that I was better off in the company. All during the day, Uncle and Father would keep up a conversation with me using what they knew of the demon's tongue, and they made me read and discuss the demon's magazines and newspapers, which some of our friends and kinsmen who worked in the demon's mansions would bring down to us. Demonic was easier to speak than to read. It was hard to understand a language that only used 26 symbols, the letters of their alphabet. The letters kept on rearranging themselves in the most confusing patterns. At about 4 o'clock, after I had gotten the fire ready again for White Deer to cook dinner, I would hurry to the Tong people's school, where I would learn the classics of the Tong people. The classics were the books supposedly written by Confucius and the ancients about the correct way to live. Some of them made sense, some of them didn't. As Uncle told me, some of it applied to everyone, including demons, and other parts of it applied only to the rich. When I came home 2 hours later from school, I would be in time to grab a quick dinner from the leftovers, wash the dishes, do my other chores and my lessons, and then go to bed. I worked 16 hours a day and had never been happier in my life. The part I liked best was when I went with Father to pick up the dirty laundry and deliver the clean. Because Father could speak more demonic than the others, he always got that job, and he usually took me along. Our wagon was painted a bright red with the company's name in demon script painted in large, bold, gold letters on its sides. The wagon was pulled by Red Rabbit, whom we kept along with the wagon in a livery stable a few blocks away in the demon section. Red Rabbit was a big, strong horse, red as fire, with a white star on his forehead. Father had named him Red Rabbit after the speedy horse of the god of war. As he jokingly said sometimes, he thought Red Rabbit would try to live up to his name, but so far the shameless beast had not. Red Rabbit was without a doubt the laziest, slowest horse in the demon land. Uncle said, half seriously, that it was associating with demons that had made Red Rabbit so lazy. Whatever the reason, neither curses, nor the whip, nor kicks, nor slaps of the reins on Red Rabbit's big rump could get him to move faster than his slow, deliberate pace, a pace which he never changed, whether we were in the flatlands or on one of the demon's steep hills. But no matter how slow he was, there was always a cube of sugar in my pants pocket. In the beginning, Uncle had not wanted me to go out with Father and Red Rabbit. It was dangerous to leave the Tong people's town. There was many a Tong man with a cracked skull or a broken arm or rib because he had crossed over the invisible boundary line between our town and the rest of the demon city. Sometimes the demon boys threw stones, and other times it was a group of restless adult demons who were out for a little sport. But Father said it was time I learned a little more of the demon city. I had already been here a month and never left the Tong people's town. He took me out only along streets that he regarded as safe, either because he knew the policemen on the beat or because some of his customers on that street had banded together and warned the demon boys and young men not to try anything. The first time we went out, I had been afraid of just about everything. I remembered stories about how the hills were made by burrowing dragons, so I was scared to death by the sound of the cable made going through the rails of the cable car tracks, a steady, rattling, clacking sound. I thought it was a dragon scrabbling at the surface with its claws just about to break free. As for the houses, they looked like wooden monsters, hunkered down along either side, waiting for me to look away from them before they would grab me. And every demon I saw, I was sure, had a stone or a knife or a gun. Father saw how I clutched the seat in sheer fright until the knuckles of my hands were almost bone white. Father began to speak quietly then of the old ones, the spirits of the dead members of our family, to whom we offered food and the sweet smell of incense that pleased them so well. For their part, the old ones watched over the living members of the family, for one's obligations to the family did not stop with death. Then Father spoke especially of the brave old ones who may have crossed over the sea to watch over us. Among these was my great-grandfather, who had died fighting the British demons when they had wanted to force the Tang people to let them sell opium in the Middle Kingdom. He was on the losing side and was beheaded for his trouble. But Father was sure that he, for one, would not miss a chance to fight demons again. Father was even more positive that the spirit of my grandfather was with us. I finally found out the truth about his death. He was a proud man who would take nonsense from nobody. One day, shortly after he had arrived, some drunken demons had tried to cut off his queue. Grandfather could have worn a wig if his queue had been cut off. He would not have been the first guest of the demons who had to resort to one, but instead Grandfather had spat in their faces and busted a few heads, and before the whole thing was finished, he was swinging from a lamppost by some demon's clothesline. Like many Tang men, he did not think of the queue as a symbol of Manchu oppression. Tang men had been wearing their hair in that way for over 8 generations, so for Grandfather, having a queue was part of being a Tang man. He would as soon lose his nose as his queue. But even if he had been a revolutionary who knew what the queue really meant and hated the thought of wearing it, there was still the principle of the matter. The demons had no right to do anything to him physically. Anyway, I understood why Grandfather had died. I let go of the seat, ashamed to let the old one see how frightened I was. Father did not give me a chance to think about how afraid I should be. He would point with excitement at some new sight or wonder with me at the meaning of something which we had seen among the demons. There were few things that escaped Father's notice, and even fewer things that Father was not interested in. Some of the houses had hitching posts cast in the shape of black demons, but in such odd clothes and of such odd colors that we could never figure them out. I learned later they were jockey clothes. Father and I speculated on the purpose of the figures, whether they were like the lions or the door gods who were meant to protect the house or what. When we started to make deliveries, I was afraid of going near the houses, but I was even more afraid of being left alone on the wagon. I went with Father, feeling a certain pride in the company's craft as I carried the clean, pressed, and starched clothes wrapped in the crisp blue paper and tied with twine into neat parcels. And then I would help Father carry the dirty laundry back. If the bundle was small, say, only about 10 pounds, Father would let me carry it back to the wagon, but sometimes, especially when we were at some mansion, I had to let Father take the load. While we did that, Father began to tell me about his life as a boy on our farm, his first years with Mother, and his first years over here in the Demon Land. But I liked it best when he sang, in his deep bass voice, some of the silly nonsense songs he and Mother used to make up when they were children. One of them he taught me went, "The fox went a-walking for to have a little flirt, but it made me so sad, for she had no skirt. The fox went a-walking down by the sloughs, but it made me so sad, for she had no shoes. The fox went a-walking down by the mall, but it made me so sad, she no clothes at all." And it went on like that for dozens of verses, going through not only articles of Tang people's clothing, but those of the demons as well, some of which, when we picked them up, amused us no end, especially the tons of petticoats and the like that demonesses had to wear. Father sang the song in such a mournful voice that he always made me laugh. During those trips alone among the demons, Father and I learned things about one another, and more, we learned about being a father and a son. Every trip was an adventure into a strange, fearful city, and yet I felt safe by my father's side. Anyone who could laugh and tell stories and jokes and sing while he was alone among the demons must know what he was doing. In my own mind, Father was the embodiment of Uncle's superior man. Only once during all those trips did we have any trouble. Some demon boys were out in the street. They stooped as if to pick up things to throw, and Father whispered to me to sit up straight and not show I was afraid. The demon boys called out some things, but we ignored them until we had passed them by. A rock whizzed by my ear and hit Red Rabbit in the side. He snorted, but plodded on as steadily as before. Then came that one fateful encounter with a demon. Because a demon can help or harm you, there is no way of telling if a demon might be testing you before he will reward you, or whether he is trying to kick you. I had been in the demon land for only 10 months, so it would have been about January of the demon's year 1904, when we met Mr. Alger. I remember it was a gray, wintry day. We were making the rounds when we saw one of the horseless carriages stranded by the sidewalk and a demon in a big overcoat standing beside it. His driving cap was pushed back, and he was scratching his forehead in a puzzled way. The metal hood on the front of the horseless had been folded back on top so you could see into its innards.
"Whoa, Red Rabbit."
Father pulled at the reins, and Red Rabbit stopped. Father set the brake, and as an extra precaution, he put the wooden block behind the wheel.
"Can I help?"
he asked. The demon was a big, cheerful-looking demon with a bland, round face. He eyed Father.
"I don't know, John."
Many demons call Tong Men John because, they insisted, they never could get the hang of our real names.
"You know anything about horselesses?"
"Some," Father said. Truth to tell, he had never handled a horseless carriage in his life, though he had a book on them and cut out articles whenever they appeared in the demon magazines and newspapers. That was the extent of Father's knowledge. But to know facts is nothing. He had an intuitive feeling for what made the horseless carriages tick. He looked around inside the engine for about 10 minutes and then wiped his face absent-mindedly so that the grease stained his cheek. He did not even notice.
"Know where there's a garage?"
the demon finally asked. Father only grunted. His eyes were shining. He had hardly heard the demon until the demon tapped him on the shoulder.
"You sabe me? Garage, repair my Oldsmobile."
As happens sometimes between two people speaking different languages, the demon had begun to shout at Father as if Father were deaf, and the demon could make his words better understood by being loud. But suddenly Father stiffened, hooked up a loose wire, and stood back.
"Horseless, ready,"
he said with a satisfied air.
"What?" "It ready."
Skeptically, the demon got back behind the wheel, while Father went to the front near the crank to start the motor. Father put his thumb against his palm instead of putting it around the crank. As he told me later, when the motor took, the crank could move suddenly and break a man's thumb if his thumb was around it. He folded his hand carefully around the crank and began vigorously winding it. The motor caught and started with a chug. The whole horseless began to shake. Father closed the hood.
"Here, John."
The demon unbuttoned his coat and reached into his pants pocket, but Father shook his head.
"No tip. Happy just to look at horseless."
The demon stopped and studied Father, as you might look at a dog that had suddenly said he was going to the opera.
"Well, I'll be damned," he said.
He reached into a pocket of his waistcoat and took out a card and handed it to Father with a flourish.
"I can use honest handymen like you. You come around any time. You sabe me?"
"Me sabe," Father nodded. Father went to hold Red Rabbit's head as the demon wrestled the brake of his carriage free with a loud ratchety sound. Then he put the clutch in. There was a loud bang of a backfire, and the horseless chugged forward. The demon grinned and waved. Father waved back. When Father climbed up beside me, he held out the card.
"Here is a lesson for you," he said.
I puzzled out the words.
"Oliver Alger, real estate agent. Properties sold and managed. 1200 Polk Street, Very good.
Father took the card and put it carefully away in his pocket.
Did you see that demon's face, Moonshadow? He was surprised when I fixed his carriage. Machines aren't all bad. Some of them may be the true magic. We might not be able to speak too well with the demons, but in machines, there's a language common to us all. You don't have to worry about your accent when you're talking about numbers and diagrams. I was getting excited. Maybe the Dragon King was right. Maybe the magic takes a different form in our land. Maybe that's why you don't need words for it.
Father wiped his hands on an old rag in the back of the wagon. Then he held up his hands. He had not been able to get off all the oil, for the lines of his hands were still black.
Well, you know, repairing the horseless carriage was a lot like healing the Dragon King. My hands just seemed to know what to do.
I leaned forward eagerly. Do you think that was the Dragon King in disguise? Do you think it was a test?
Father gave my cue a friendly tweak. You're too ready to find tests everywhere, he grinned. Why can't he just be a demon?
But White Deer says there are good demons and bad demons. But was he showing us something good or bad? Was it...
You talk too much.
Father clicked his tongue and shook his reins, and Red Rabbit started forward again. But whatever Father said to me, his meeting with the demon made him look doubly hard through the demon's papers for signs of the true magic. It might have been that Father secretly took the meeting and the successful repairing of the horseless carriage as a test, but did not want to tell me. Or probably it was simply the change in the demon's attitude from being surly to being friendly that encouraged Father. At any rate, he studied the papers even harder than I did. But not only did I have to learn the demon's language, I also had to learn how to measure time by two calendars. There was the demon's calendar, which was based on the movements of the sun with its fixed number of days and months and its seven-day weeks. And there was the true time of our own home, with its calendar based on the movements of the moon, so that the first day of our new year changed with each year, as did many of our holidays. Then, too, our week was 10 days long. But above all, I wanted to learn Tong words so I could write Mother myself and be able to read her letters on my own. And there were a lot of letters, for she had begun to dictate twice a week to the school teacher. In her part of the letter, Grandmother had grumbled a bit about the expense. Not that she begrudged us the extra letters, but their budget was a bit tight. But Mother, in her part of the letter, had argued that they now had twice as many loved ones to write to in the land of the Golden Mountain. Father had told them that we would tighten our belts a bit over here and try to send Dawn some extra money to cover the mail expenses. In the meantime, we had done our best to match them letter for letter so that they got their money's worth in return. Of course, in her next letter, Grandmother had wanted to know how come we could suddenly afford to pay for double the mail load. Grandmother became quiet, though, when I added my own lines to one of Father's letters. I first wrote to them in late November of the demon year 1903, but because of the distances, it took 2 months, a month for our letter to reach them and a month for their letter to reach us, for their reply to reach us. That would have made it the first month of our year 4061, but early February of the demon's year 1904. Mother told us how proud she and Grandmother were. The school teacher himself had exclaimed over my handwriting and vocabulary, both of which I owed more to Lefty's private tutoring than to my teacher in school. My mother added that she wished I were there to help her go through our box of Father's old letters, for there were now many passages she had forgotten over the years. I suddenly felt very guilty. For in all the excitement of slowly learning about Father and living in the demon land, I had not really had time to think about Mother. But now I remembered about how it used to be, sitting on the edge of the rice field as she waded through the brown, clouded water. I remembered, too, how after the dinner dishes had been washed and dried, we would sit by the small hearth and look at the fire and think of things that we ought to tell Father in our next letter. Or how, when we had come back from the schoolmaster, we would spread out one of Father's letters and pretend to read it to one another. Mother had always been good at that. For she would have the schoolteacher repeat a section she was not sure of, despite the schoolteacher's grumbling. When she got home, she could almost recite the letter by heart. She must have done the same thing with the parts of the letter that I had written.
"What's the matter, boy?"
Father asked. But as much as I would have liked to, I found it impossible to tell him about my feelings, though I think he suspected. He pretended to become very severe with me.
"Now don't you go getting a swelled head by what the schoolteacher says, boy."
And Father set me to reading the letter out loud, helping me with the more difficult words. Then, after setting me to another lesson, Father went through a pile of old demon newspapers and magazines that one of our friends had brought down from some demon house in which he was employed as a houseboy. Suddenly, Father waved the New York Herald magazine at me. It was a fairly recent one, dated January 17, 1904. I know the date because I still have it. One rich demon subscribed to the paper and had it shipped to him all the way across the country. It always boggled my mind to think of the great mountains and wide rivers across which he had people bring the papers just for his reading pleasure. Father spread the magazine out before me. I saw a series of drawings of a box-like contraption. Father pointed to the big letters beneath the picture.
"This means the demon flew."
"Flew?" I said excitedly.
"That's what it says. A pair of demon brothers by the name of Wright flew in an aeroplane."
Father's tongue rolled over the syllables. He pronounced the demon word again as if delighted by the sheer sound of the full vowels.
"An aeroplane."
"Were they given the wings by the Dragon King?" I asked.
Father laughed. "No."
He tousled my hair affectionately.
"Not so they say. They repair bicycles. But what some demon did, I can do."
His eyes had gone as deep as they had when he had spoken of learning to fly on that strange beach. The others were down on the second floor, where our dining room kitchen doubled as a gaming room in the evenings, when the dishes had been cleared away. Only Uncle was not excited by the demon magazine. He folded his arms across his chest and pondered his next move at the Tong people's chess, which is slightly different from demon chess. For one thing, there is a river across the board. Finally, Uncle pushed a chariot forward and sat back for White Deer to make his move.
"It's probably just some fairy tale for children," Uncle said. "You just haven't read it the right way."
"No, no, it's fact," Father insisted. "You can't trust everything you read in the demon's papers," Uncle observed loftily.
He was sitting in his special treasure, a chair which the founder of the company had built and carved from teakwood brought all the way from the Middle Kingdom. The head of the company always sat in that chair. Uncle treated his chair very much like a throne in which no one else was allowed to sit. When Uncle was settled into his chair, he did not so much speak as make proclamations. So we knew better than to argue with him at that time. I could not understand why Uncle took such a stubborn attitude against the fact that some demon had flown. Father went to the demon's library and read through all the newspapers gathered from around the country, and he copied out the accounts of them. All of these Uncle refused to believe were true, but a few days later, we received our next sign. Melonhead was a laundryman in Oakland. He had gotten that name because he had gone completely bald in his younger days. He belonged to the same guild as we did, and often caught the ferry over to attend the guild meetings. He was an old friend of Uncle's, and usually dropped by our place for a snack after he and Uncle had gone to the meeting. Uncle was not feeling his best that night. He had quarreled again with Black Dog, over what no one knew, but Black Dog had walked out in a huff. Uncle's mood was not helped any by Melonhead's news. Over tea, he told us about some crazy demon, Baldwin, who put air into a big canvas bag and then floated up into the sky, where he was under the control of the winds. He had a special sausage-shaped canvas bag built for him, maybe about 30 feet long. It was covered with a giant net which went down to its belly, from which a wooden frame was suspended. There were propellers and a motor in the frame, and they sent the bag lumbering through the air so he could guide his own flight. It was one of the pioneer dirigibles, but at that time we thought of it as almost a miracle. It was called the California Arrow, though Red Rabbit was a rocket compared to it. The real crazy thing was that the demon was testing it so that he could race it at a big fair held at one of the demon's inland cities and maybe win some money in a contest being held for flying machines. The demon then planned to take it all around the demon's land and charge people admission to see him fly.
Can you imagine flying and making money at it too? I said wonderingly.
No, I can't, because it's too risky to fly. Better to stay on the ground and do something you know you can make money at.
Uncle spoke in his sternest voice. But supposing he does, Father said.
You're crazy. First you want to bring your wife and your boy over to this place to live, and now you want to fly like a bird. Next thing I know, you'll be collecting twigs for a nest.
And you have a mouth that runs on, old man,
White Deer snapped. It was one of the few times I had ever seen him look angry.
You weren't supposed to talk about that.
Uncle glanced first at me, and then at Father, guiltily. You were going to bring Mother over as well? I asked.
The demons will let a merchant bring his wife over. But I have to be a partner in the store, Father said.
But then how did you bring me over?
I asked.
You came here as a merchant's son, Father said. We got a paper saying that I was a partner in the store and owned $1,000 worth of property here, but that was only for the demons. I actually don't have a share in the store.
But you could bring Mother over with that piece of paper.
Uncle cleared his throat. He did not like what he had to say.
Not while I'm the head of this company. I'd go to the demons and tell them that paper was a lie.
But if the demons knew that Father wasn't a real partner in the store, they might send me home as well, I said. And maybe the demons would even send Father back home because he lied.
Yes, well.
Uncle scratched uncomfortably at his ear and peered at the wall.
I'd rather lose both of you than see you bring your poor mother over here. What kind of place is this for her when we're afraid to set foot outside our own door?
You used to tell me how no one would ever fly, either,
White Deer pointed out.
And yet, the demons are.
And I bet the families of those demons are going hungry right now, Uncle declared smugly, and all because of someone's crazy dream.
Father was going to argue with Uncle some more, but White Deer shook his head. There was no use going on.
Come, Father said to me. It's time for you to go to bed.
We said goodnight to Melonhead and left. I kept quiet when we got to our room, but it was obvious from my face that I wanted to talk. Father sighed.
Well, out with it before you bust.
Were you really going to bring Mother over here?
It's only a dream of ours, Shadow, Father said gently.
Before I left home, your mother and I secretly agreed to do it if it could be managed. But I'm more likely to fly again in this life than to bring your mother over here.
But perhaps you will fly, I said. What better test of your dragonness than if you could fly in a soft-skinned body? And if you could do that hard task, Uncle would have to believe you were once a real dragon, and then he would respect you even more than he does, and he would do what you say. Then you could bring Mother over.
You talk too much, boy,
Father laughed. But he looked thoughtful. He pulled the quilt up about my neck. Then he turned the gas down on our gaslight. As I fell asleep, I could see him sitting on his mat, weighing the possibilities of what I had said. The next day, after we had had our morning rice, Uncle came over to Father.
Oh, my head.
Uncle touched his fingers to his temples.
I drank too much wine last night.
Father grunted. He wet one finger and lifted an iron from the rack on the stove where it had been heating. He tested it by putting his finger next to the iron. The moisture on Father's finger evaporated, making a soft, sizzling sound, so Father knew it was ready without any discomfort to himself. He looked up from the iron.
You stiff-necked old goat, Father said. Why don't you apologize and be done with it?
Now, Uncle was a proud man, and it had probably taken him most of last evening and this morning just to work himself up to this point where he would make excuses for his actions. But you could never force him to admit he was wrong. Uncle pressed his lips tightly together, and his eyebrows drew closer together.
What makes you think I was going to say I was sorry?
Father spread a shirt out on the ironing board.
I don't think when I'm around you. You do all the thinking for me. Well, someone has to. You can't be left on your own, a grown man your age playing with demon toys. You're a fool. A stupid, stupid fool. Especially for wanting to bring your wife and family over to this place.
White Deer bent over and whispered in my ear. I could smell the soap on his hands. Don't think too badly of Uncle. He's angry at his son, and he grieves for him. But he holds all that anger and grief inside him. He's just taking those feelings out on the nearest person. But that still doesn't make it right. No, but neither would resenting Uncle's words. He doesn't mean them. He thinks your father's taken to flying the way that Lefty once was taken by gambling, and the way that Black Dog is owned by his opium pipe. In the meantime, the argument between father and uncle had reached the shouting point.
Go away, old man. Go away before I hit you with this iron, father said.
He turned away from uncle and bent over the enamel bowl on the left side of the ironing board. He sucked his mouth full of water and then spat the water out forcefully in one large explosion so that the entire shirt was sprayed with water. It was some way father held his teeth and lips that made the water spray like that. Father very calmly began to iron. Uncle snorted and stalked away. But after 10 days, Black Dog still had not come back. It was White Deer who joined Father beside his ironing board.
Black Dog's been gone a long time, White Deer said.
Father's arm went back and forth rhythmically across the sheet, smoothing out the wrinkles.
Yes, he has, he grudged.
He's never been away this long, White Deer added.
Huh,
Father grunted.
Opium costs too much. He's never had enough money for a binge as long as this.
Hmm.
We ought to look for him.
Father sighed and set the iron he'd been using back onto the stove rack. He took off another one that had been heating there and wet his thumb to test it.
I suppose we ought to, he said finally.
That night after dinner, Lefty began our confrontation with Uncle.
I understand that Leopardhead is down from the North Country with his pockets full of money. I think I may get into a game.
Leopardhead was a cook for the demons on some ranch up to the north. The point was that he was a member of the Brotherhood of Eternal Repose, nicknamed the Sleepers. It was their enemies and not the brothers who rested eternally. The same brotherhood to which Black Dog belonged and would be staying at their hall. If Black Dog was at the hall, Lefty could find out.
If you see my worthless boy, Uncle grumbled, spit in his face for me.
No one is worthless, Uncle,
White Deer chided him gently.
He comes the closest to it of any Tong man I have ever seen.
Uncle mopped his brow with his handkerchief. The air was still hot and steamy inside our building.
He's probably too ashamed to come back,
Hand Clap contributed.
Yes, that's it, White Deer said. He'll probably come back like a small dog with its tail slung between its legs.
That boy knows no shame.
He's still a member of the company.
Ha! I've got a mind to fire that boy.
White Deer shrugged.
You can't fire someone from the company unless your two partners agree, and Hand Clap and I will never do that.
But Uncle was still too proud to say he wanted help to look for his boy.
None of you are to look for him. Understand?
White Deer looked at his friend for a long time.
Well, there's no objection if I take a walk, is there?
Uncle sat for a long time in his chair, drumming his fingers on the chair's arms.
No, I guess I can't keep you from going for walks.
He pushed himself up from his chair suddenly. He picked up his hat from a peg.
I think I'll visit Whirlwind. Haven't seen that old fool in a long time.
Whirlwind also was a sleeper. Uncle walked down the steps. The bell tinkled as he slammed the door.
We ought to split up the rest of the Tong people's town, Father said. I'll take the opium dens.
No, let me,
White Deer said.
No, Father said. It makes more sense for you to go among your friends in the restaurants and ask for Black Dog. He's got to eat sometime. Hand Clap, you can cover the brothels. You know them all so well.
Hand Clap looked embarrassed when we all laughed.
Not that well, he mumbled. Leave the gambling places to me.
Lefty slipped a silver dollar out of his pocket. Father caught his wrist.
This is serious business, Lefty.
Lefty smiled.
Relax. I will not use this for gambling, only for buying drinks. There is nothing like wine to loosen tongues.
All right.
Father let go of his wrist. What about me? I asked.
Boy, you stay here.
I want to go with you. Father shook his head.
Where I'm going, nobody should have to go. What would your mother say?
Before I left, she told me to look after you. You'll need someone to watch your back for you.
This boy is quite right, you know, Lefty said. Some dopey might be just desperate enough to tackle you.
Father drummed his fingers on the countertop.
It's very ugly, boy. You'll think you're in the court of hell.
All the more reason to have someone you can trust there.
Father cocked his head to one side.
I do think you've grown an inch since you've come here.
More like a foot, I said.
You've been using Handclap's ruler again, Father laughed. Let's get started.
He jammed my hat onto my head. We headed for the alley that is known as the Devil's Kitchen. There was a different kind of smell to the alley. It was a sweet yet bad kind of smell. We paused at the mouth of the alley. Overhead, the moon shone through the bars of the fire escape as it kept pace with us as we walked inside like some restless animal pacing in its cage. It was pitch black in the alley mouth. Without the moonlight, we would have stumbled over the man who lay moaning against the wall. Is he? I began.
No, Father said. Just trying to sleep. If he had any money, he'd be inside.
We turned the corner of the building into a kind of courtyard formed by that building and two others. One gas lamp lit the yard. Father kept his hand on my shoulder.
Keep close to me, he cautioned.
We started down the steps into a basement. A bald-headed man perched on a stool behind a counter, his feet inside the rungs. He acted as if he were in some kind of a store. He was sipping a cup of tea with one hand while the other rested on his thigh. The rest of the basement was given over to beds, each of which had a little table beside it. On each table rested a nut oil lamp, which was used to heat up the pellet of opium before it was put into the long-stemmed pipe. Later, when I went into a demon hospital, it was to remind me very much of a scrubbed-up antiseptic opium den. On the straw mattresses, men lay in various positions, but of the faces I could see, each of them wore a moronic kind of grin. One man had just put his heated pellet into his pipe. His lips sucked happily at the pipe, which was as long as my arm. Each time he sucked, there was an evil kind of frying sound. The pellet was only good for several lungfuls, but that was enough. The air itself was thick with the smell of opium and with stale sweat and vomit and urine. The man at the counter put a pellet down on the counter.
"I'm looking for my cousin," Father said.
The man scratched his forehead with his left little finger. The casual gesture must have actually been some recognition sign. Father scratched the little finger on his right hand.
"You don't look like a brother," the man said. "I'm not," Father said. "But I once knew men from the Heavenly Order Brotherhood. That was back in 97 in the little city."
The little city was what we called the demons Sacramento, the provincial capital up to the north.
"I hear the fighting was messy," the man behind the counter said. "What did you say your name was?"
"I didn't say." Father looked around the room.
"Well, who are you looking for?"
"A man called Black Dog."
"And he's your cousin?"
The man at the counter sat back, satisfied.
"So, you're the man they call Windrider now."
"Is Black Dog here?"
"No, but I'll send word to your laundry if he does come here."
The man gestured toward a teapot.
"Have some tea?"
he offered, just as if he were in his home.
"No thanks," Father said. "But I'd appreciate that word if he shows up."
"My pleasure," the man said.
As we stepped outside, I turned to Father.
"What fighting?"
"Never you mind, boy," Father said.
We went to three other dens, but we had no luck. We were just coming out of the third den when we saw three men appear in the courtyard. Father pressed me back against the door, so we were hidden in the shadowed doorway.
They walked side by side, very deliberately. The two other men who were in the courtyard scuttled out of their way. The sound of the boots echoed hollowly off the walls. The man on the right jerked his head at a basement opium den we had yet to try.
"The pig's in there. Bring him out," said the man in the middle.
Father tightened his hand on my shoulder, and he put his finger to his lips, telling me I was to be silent. The man on the right disappeared into the den. There were protests from inside, and he reappeared a moment later, half carrying a man who was naked to the waist. Two men followed him.
"You just can't come breaking into our place like this and taking out one of our customers. You justices can't push us around even if you are the biggest. There are rules now. Every brotherhood has its own territory."
The man in the middle held out his right hand. The man on the left lifted up his loose black shirt and pulled out the heavy pistol that he had stuck under his waistband. He handed it to the man in the middle. The man who had been protesting stopped and dropped to his knees.
"We don't want to start a war with you, bloody hands, but we will if we have to," said the man in the middle.
He nodded at the dopey, who had been dragged out of the den.
"This pig stole money from one of our foxes. He beat her up, too, so she wouldn't talk." "So that's how he got all his money," said the other man from the den.
The man on his knees got up and spat at the dopey.
"Take him and good riddance. You can't get any lower than stealing money from a woman."
The two men hurried back inside their den. The third justice propped the dopey up against the railing that ran along the steps to the basement and stepped to one side. I saw it was Black Dog then. He looked up, confused, studying the three men for a moment until he recognized them. I'll give Black Dog this much. He smiled rather than being afraid.
"Lead Hand," Black Dog said to the man in the middle. "I'm going to remember this in the next life, and I'm going to take definite pleasure in tromping every worm, cockroach, and fly that I meet. I'm sure one of them will be you." "I never stole any money from any fox," Lead Hand said. "Don't be so sure as to who's going to come back as what."
Lead Hand cocked the pistol. You could hear the loud mechanical click. Suddenly, I heard a shrill, piercing whistle from above me. I looked up to see Father with two fingers in his mouth. He emitted another whistle as I watched. It was a decidedly demonic talent. I don't think the gunmen would have mistaken Father's whistle for the sound of the police if they had been calm, but of course they were nervous and excited about the killing. The man on Lead Hand's left turned to run, but Lead Hand grabbed his arm.
"The gun, you fool, the gun!"
Dumbly, the young man let Lead Hand give him the gun. Then the three of them ran like mad for the alleyway.
"Where did you learn to whistle like that?"
I asked with open envy.
"Something I picked up," Father said.
"Think you could teach me?"
"Yes, it might just come in handy for you."
Father started down the steps three at a time, running toward Black Dog, who lay sprawled across the railing, his legs spread out on the steps. He twisted his head up. He had difficulty focusing his eyes, but finally he recognized Father.
"You,"
he said.
"Yes, me. We've come to take you back to the company."
Father bent over and tried to help Black Dog to his feet, but Black Dog pushed Father's hand away.
"Don't want. Don't need,"
Black Dog mumbled.
"Oh, hell," Father said.
He swung his fist into Black Dog's jaw with a solid smack. Black Dog sagged on the railing. Father crouched and got Black Dog over his shoulders and walked slowly up the steps. I was waiting for him at the top.
"Get his hat and things,"
Father said. But I was staring up at Black Dog.
"Remember,"
Father said.
"He was a good man once. Now get his things."
I got Black Dog's hat and shirt and joined Father, who had already started to walk toward the alley mouth.